But it's been good discussion, I think, and some good application that we have been able to consider and been able to make. And to just kind of remember where we were here in this discussion. You know, Nehemiah and those who are rebuilding the wall have realized that their enemies have come back again to try to stop the progress, to stop the work that was being done. And Nehemiah has stood up as one who has, you know, guarded against the enemy. And our point in our discussion, our last class, we're making application to the text. And that discussion had to do with the fact that leaders cannot take their eye off of the goal, even when enemies are closing in tight. And that's how it was with Nehemiah and those enemies who had come against them. That Nehemiah stood as a defender of God and of God's people. And we've seen that to be the pattern with Nehemiah. On page 12, on the bottom of the page, we were beginning to have some discussion on the fact that Nehemiah kept the people on task by staying focused. Look at our text here for just a moment, Nehemiah 4. And let's read again, beginning in verse 7. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to the Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and to fight against Jerusalem, to stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also our enemies said, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." And therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. And after I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." And when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. Again, the bottom of page 12. Nehemiah kept the people on task by staying focused. I think we may have mentioned last time this point that, have you noticed, when you're working on a project, sometimes the first half seems to go a lot quicker than the second half. When you get halfway done, you know, you're ready to be done. But you're not done. You're only halfway there. And that's kind of where the Jews were at on rebuilding the wall. I'm sure at this point they wanted to be done. They were tired. They were exhausted. The laborers were giving out, as the text would say. And now their enemy is back again and putting pressure on them. They just wanted to be done, but they weren't. And so now the pressure that's on Nehemiah is to keep the people focused, to keep them on task. Unity, it seems to be one of the first things that disappears when a project is half done. And that's where the people were. And one of the challenges for leaders is to instill and encourage a spirit of unity when it is, in fact, the devil who's trying to destroy the same, when he's trying to destroy that. And so let's think for a moment here, and let's try to make some application, you know, to the Lord's church. How can leaders communicate in a way that inspires and builds up? I mean, we see what Nehemiah's facing. We see what he's having to do. What happens when the Lord's church is attacked that way? You know, what must leaders do to inspire and build up? Now, what comes to your mind with that? What's the application that we need to make?
Perhaps praying for a specific prayer to be answered. You know, you can attack someone. Saying you need a nomination of world, but I'm not using instrumental music. Being able to give a scriptural defense for why we practice the things that we do practice.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in some of the things that Nehemiah has said. It has been with the goal of kind of refocusing people. Even his prayers have been focused. Have you noticed that? I mean, there's something to be said with that. I mean, what else can we say? How can we stay focused? How can leaders keep the church focused?
That's a cliche, keep your eye on the prize, but really keep your eye on God. Mm-hmm. I think is the thing that has to be said, that God is the one who is in control of all things. He's all powerful. No matter what's going on around you, you know, you can have faith in him. And I often think of Jesus and the disciples in the boat asleep. And they're freaking out because there's a storm there, and they think they're perishing. And he said, "I'm not going to let anything happen to you."
Yeah.
And he calms the storm, this thing that is so threatening. Mm-hmm. I think it's such a great illustration of God's
Absolutely.
Power and control over our lives.
And what did Nehemiah say to them? Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Kind of focusing these thoughts here once again. Absolutely.
In verse 9, he says, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God. And because of them, we set a watch against them day and night." And so he did not see himself above the group, although he's in essence leading. He saw himself as part of the group. And so the way to inspire and encourage God's people is to be never to rise above God's people. There's only one head of the church, that's Jesus.
Sure.
Everybody else is servants.
Sure. Absolutely. And you know, we've kind of seen this theme with Nehemiah all the way through from about chapter 2, this we philosophy, you know. And what a powerful point that is for us to see and to understand. And that even though he was a leader, he was still a part of what was needing to be done. He was still there with them in that powerful, blessed endeavor.
It's probably impossible for us to realize how valuable assembling together is, mm-hmm. like we're doing now.
Sure.
And for the worship service. the structure that God has placed for the church, for his people, to assemble and to worship, to pray, to read scriptures, to study, to sing, to hear messages from his word, to hear the Lord suffer. All of these things are beyond value for us in our faith. Because it's faith building to know that when I come, that Frank's going to be here, and Dave's going to be here, and
right.
Rick's going to be here, and other people are going to be here, that I don't come to an empty building.
Mm-hmm. And we miss those who are not here. Because something's out of place.
Exactly. And I think as far as us being able to withstand our enemies, that's one of the most valuable things that we have.
Absolutely.
Is the fact that we assemble together and we know that we're not alone and that we know that God is on our side.
Can't we imagine that this has always been part of God's plan? I mean, the strength even that we have and we receive from one another when we are assembled together. That's one of the earliest things that he had the Jews do, was to assemble together. And right after the establishment of the Lord's church, what did the church start doing? Assembling together. You know, there's power in that, in building that unity. And that's kind of the key theme here, is the idea of unity. Daryl.
Well, less said, much better. But what I was just going to say was that none of the people were asked to guard a spot of the wall by themselves.
Good point. Absolutely. Good point. That's right.
At the same time, each family was given a part of the work to do, so uh-huh. that there was also personal pride uh-huh. involved. You know, I've got to do my job because now it can be compared to the others, but we're all working together to get a common wall built. Mm-hmm. So I think that Nehemiah has had people working together, but each with their own separate job to do. And I think each one of us Christians have our own job to mm-hmm. do. And we can't just come to the worship service and let Joe do it.
It's interesting that while we can see that each individual had responsibility and a job to do, it was being done together and collectively, and Nehemiah was there with them. You know, I mean, here again, as the leader, he didn't make some assignment, and then he's like gone, he's out of sight. I mean, there was individual responsibilities, no doubt. But the unity of the group working together is something that really, really stands out. Okay, well, you know, uncertainty is a powerful threat. And that's what the enemy was using against the Jews here, was the uncertainty. When is the attack going to come? And of course, they had sent that message. The Jews outside the wall had heard 10 times over the threats that we're going to kill them. We're going to come in and kill them. And they've told the ones inside. How does that make you feel? You know, to be hearing it, even from your own kinspeople, so to speak. You know, we've heard what they're planning to do. You know, and so, I mean, when's it going to happen? Is it going to happen today, tomorrow, tonight? They're going to catch us when we're sleeping? I mean, uncertainty is what will just eat us up sometime. That's a powerful tool. And the enemy knew how to use that. All right, making some application here. How does Satan work that same fear in us today? How does he do that?
Look at the failure side of things. Well, I can't do that. This is going to happen. You look at your worst case scenario, that's what I call it sometimes. You know, and you let that affect your judgment, your reasoning, and your motivation. Mm-hmm. We can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Satan is good at that. That's what he does well, is make us, I was going to say make us doubt ourselves, but it's not so much doubting ourselves, is it? Isn't it more of doubting God is what it kind of comes down to?
Usually tries to plant a seed of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But you're thinking opposite of what God has in mind.
I mean, that's a powerful tool. And we can see here on different occasions how that's the tool, you know, that Satan has tried to employ here. You don't know what's going to happen next. You know, years ago in industry, after 9/11 and, you know, the attack on Al-Qaeda and stuff like that, they kept kind of lobbing Scud missiles. Remember that? They weren't very reliable missiles. They didn't exactly know where they were going to go and what they were going to hit. But that was the big fear. You know, a Scud missile was going to come into our troops or something like that. And in industry sometime, you know, that kind of became our thing. We got hit by a Scud over on line 2 today. You know, you never know what's going to happen sometimes. You know, you have a machine that crashes and breaks and production comes to a stop. And, okay, we got hit, you know, by a Scud on line 2, machine 3. We got to get some more help over here. And so the next day things are running good. Well, things are going great today till the next Scud hits. I mean, you just never knew what was going to happen, what was going to come next. Well, what's going to be the next Scud on the church? Where's the next missile coming from? What's going to be the next issue that has to be faced? You know, how do we deal with that?
Well, the Ecclesiastes says that there's no new thing under the sun. So what has been, our problem is we lose sight of that. We think that the next issue is some new issue.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes Satan influences there, but a lot of times the problem is it's Nick, it's me. I don't trust God. I'm trusting what I see. I'm no longer walking my faith, I'm walking my sight. I trust the news, because the news is, you know, it tells me this is going to happen, and so this must be happening.
Mm-hmm.
I trust everything I can see, touch, taste. And I don't trust the thing that God told me to trust. In fact, the problem is not everything around me, the problem is me. And thus our faith has to grow.
Everything old is made to look new sometime by the hands of Satan. Sin is that way. Discouragement is that way. Issues and problems that the church has to face is that way. The bottom line, the common denominator is always the same. We get back to a lack of faith in God, a lack of reliance on Him and on His Word, lack of confidence that He is with us when we are walking in truth. All of these things can demoralize churches. I've seen that happen, and likely many of you have too. And what you see really has happened is that somehow we've taken our eye off of the goal. We've taken our eye off of what's most important. We've taken our eye off of God. and where power and strength comes from. And that's been one of the things that I've appreciated so much here with Nehemiah, is every time there's been an issue, you've noticed this, every time there's been an issue, there's been a reminder that God is on our side, or there's been a prayer, you know, don't be afraid of them, remember the Lord who is great and awesome. You know, he's already identified over and over, God is on our side. And of course, it was with that, you know, that it seems they kind of got a resurgence, they got refocused, and they got about the work. They had to make some changes about how they got about the work. Okay, they had to make some alterations in that, as we're going to see as we read on, you know, because the situation around, for them to get the work done, demanded that they go about some things a little bit differently. But Satan did not win. Their enemies did not win. And they did not take their eye off of what was there. You know, our confidence has to be found in God. And it takes a certain focus to do that. And if Satan can somehow change our focus, he wins. That's how he wins. When we take our eyes off of God, we cannot lose sight of who we are. We can't lose sight of the fact that our citizenship is in heaven. You know, and these are the things that we have to look at, that there's a kingdom that Christ is reigning over now, and we are a part of that kingdom. And we have to understand. And so having a common goal really helps us to see and to get those things done. We're looking at lesson 7. Moving on to lesson 7, page 13. Has everybody have lesson 7 now? Did you pick one up coming in? Anybody needing one, maybe I should ask. Anybody needing lesson 7, where'd they go? Here they are. I've got some extras here. I got some extras here, Ken. Pass these down and share those around. Who else? You know, what do you suppose that wall looked like that they were building around the city? You know, when you see, you know, artist renditions of that. I've got some more here, Ken, if you need them. Okay. You get this picture of, you know, the great big old blocks that make up the wall around the city. And in a later time, as they call it the Herodian period, when King Herod had great influence on building the walls of the city, in fact, it was huge stones that were hewn that made up the walls around the city. But I get the impression now, really, that as you can see in this photograph on the page, it's not very good, but this is a picture of the wall. We saw this when we were in Jerusalem. I didn't know that an old portion of the wall, this is part of Nehemiah's wall, as they call it, the wall that was rebuilt in the old city in the days of Nehemiah. It's about 20 feet wide. And what's been exposed here, this part that's been dug up, is, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet deep. And there was a gauge on the wall over there that showed how tall they believed that the wall was, which was much taller than that. It was probably 20 feet high or something like that. But if you look at that, it's made up of stones like this. And it's mixed with dirt, or perhaps they had some kind of mortar they mixed with it. I don't know what it was exactly. But this is a portion of Nehemiah's wall as it's been uncovered in the old city of Jerusalem. And so that gives us a little bit of an idea of what they were doing. Because in my mind, when I was thinking about, you know, those who were working with a sword in their hand and helping to build the wall, I'm thinking, how could they move those huge stones, you know, with one hand? You know, there's part of me thinking like, I'm not seeing how this is happening, you know. All right, well, now I've got a little bit different view of how that was happening. I'm not saying it was easy, because even to pick up a stone this big and to carry it with one hand, one arm, is not an easy task. But this is how the wall was being rebuilt. And this is the kind of wall that was being rebuilt in that day. And so as we've seen already, as we've said, and actually, you know, the wall now, chapter 4, is at half its I don't know exactly how high that is. Is it 10 feet tall now? which, I mean, that makes it even harder to do, because now there has to be something built, scaffold, that you're walking upon to be able to put the stones up on top. And there are some, as we're going to read here in a moment, some who are standing there in full armor, they're ready to fight. And there are those who are working on the wall that are carrying a sword. Some, you know, have got a weapon in their hand, and they're working with the other hand, you know, building this wall. That's incredible to me to think about that. And we already just read, I mean, that the laborers were already exhausted. In 52 days, they built a complete wall. Let's say they're halfway, that it's halfway done, that it's taken, you know, 30 days at this point. And they are exhausted, and they're only halfway there. Remember what we were saying, sometimes the first half of a project, how quick it goes, and now you're tired, and now that second half of the project is the hard time, the hardest part, it seems, to get done. Well, that's kind of where some things are now. And maybe it was when that wall was at half the height that the enemies realized that, well, they really are going to get this done. I mean, they're really moving along on this. If we're going to attack, we better hurry up, because they're going to get the wall done. Can't you imagine that at some point earlier on, they thought, that they've started this before, they'll never get this done. But now there's the pressure on the enemy. If they're going to do something, they've got to do it right away. Because there's some places now where maybe they can get over the wall. But if they keep building this wall, that's going to become impossible for them to do. And so Satan is trying to discourage the workers here. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 16. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword on his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time, I also said to the people, "Have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve as guards by night and workmen by day." Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor guards with me took off our clothes. We each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Wow. I mean, that's focus. That's diligence here. I mean, they've come to a critical point here where faith could have evaporated, where focus could have gone away, where Satan could have discouraged them to a point where they said, "We can't do it. Why do we even start? We're never going to get this done. Even if we get it close, you know, our enemies are just on the other side. They're going to come in at night, and they're going to kill us all. I mean, it hasn't even been worth starting. Why did we even do this?" I mean, can't you hear the arguments that some could have easily made? Though I don't really see that in the text. Perhaps there were some that way, but I'm not seeing that. Some concern, were they tired? Yes. But Nehemiah has always been focused on the same thing. Don't be afraid. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. It's that refocus. You know, it's, okay, we're going to have to go about this a different way. Every man carry his weapon with him. We got to keep building the ward. Remember, our God will fight for us. That's a powerful, powerful thought. To think and to have in mind that our God will fight for us. Even when we are limited in ability and power and might, God is limited in nothing and in no way. So think about some of these things here as the people are having to go back to work and what would be on their mind. I mean, it's easy to cast doubt. I mean, when we start thinking about application here in time, in the church, it's easy to cast doubt. It's easy for one person to say, well, you know how they are really like, or you know what that preacher is trying to accomplish, or you know those elders, they've got something up their sleeve. You know what I'm saying? It's easy to cast doubt. But there has to be that continued focus on where strength and power comes from.
Fascinating point here is, in spite of the fact that, you know, he knows, he believes, he's communicating to them that God is going to fight for them, that God is with them, that does not take away their responsibility to act. Mm-hmm. And so they still have to do their part. And that's what God expects. Mm-hmm. They couldn't just say, well, we have enemies, and we won't do anything. We won't guard anything, because God's going to fight for us. That wasn't the message. The message is that we still have to do our part, and we can always trust that God will do his part. And the book of John talks about Lazarus, Mary Martha's brother, who died. And when Jesus came to the tomb, Jesus, you know, wherever he laid him, they showed him there's a stone in the tomb. Jesus says, move the stone. And then he tells Lazarus to come forth. Mm-hmm. You notice in that text that Jesus doesn't move the stone, but he could. Mm-hmm. But he told them to move the stone. Perhaps one application from that text is, you do your part, mm-hmm. and I'll do my part. You
That's
move
right.
the stone, I'll raise the dead.
That's right.
We still have to do our part.
When Jesus sent out the 12, well, first he sent out the 7, he sent out the 12, preaching the kingdom of God was at hand. I mean, why did he do that? Why did he need to do that? He is the Son of God. But God has always used those who were his faithful to carry his message. I mean, he has always used those who are willing to be his servants to do the work that God has seen and deemed that needed to be done. And application can be made here as well with Nehemiah in that way. You know, it's we've tried to get a picture in our mind of the scene here kind of as it's unfolded, and now it's changed a little bit with half of the men, you know, working on the wall, the other half in full fighting gear. And trying to picture those who are building the wall with a weapon in their hand, which is just unreal to me, how much more difficult that would make it. I mean, they were already tired, okay? And now their work is increased, it seems to me. And even if they worked from dawn until the stars came out, they worked all day. And then Nehemiah asks, as if he can ask something more of them. He asks them, don't leave, don't go home tonight, but stay here and help guard the city. And what's interesting is that they did that. You know, they were willing to do that. And that's just incredible to me. And so with those thoughts in our mind, let's think about here. I mean, what points can be made about working together? You know, in the case of those building the wall, by working together, they were accomplishing the task of rebuilding the wall. But what could have destroyed that harmony? What could have brought the process there to a stop? What could have happened?
We see the enemy has started a propaganda movement against them, saying we're going to kill them. The propaganda was out there. We're going to 10 times over and all this kind of stuff. We're really going to take them apart. But they came together. This has got to be the deflating part to the enemy. Because they weren't supposed to fight. They were going to run. They were going to get out of the way. They were not going to let us come in. They're just going to get out of the way. We can take this wall. The wall continues to grow. Their trust in God continues to grow. And the enemy then is going to be weaker here because, wow, this was supposed to be easy. We should have just been able to send out our pamphlets and everybody would go. But they didn't do that.
And it seems like that as they continue building here, the enemy kind of like goes, oh, wow. I mean,
it's going to happen.
Yeah, look at what's going on. You know, it almost seems like, to me, this, the impression, it's almost like a surprise to the enemy. I mean, what if a small group inside had said, okay, look, I've had it, you know, I've had enough. Or said to Nehemiah, you know, who do you think you are? You know, you're not even from here. You know, I mean, I'm tired of listening to you. How that would have changed the dynamics of some things that was going on. But somehow there was a common goal maintained. You know, that Nehemiah was always able to put before them, here's the goal, here's what we're doing, here's what we've got to get done. And God's on our side. God will fight for us. And they never lost sight of that goal. And so it says a lot about the leadership, but it also says so much about those who were helping to build the wall, their willingness to follow direction, their willingness to work hard, their willingness to get along. You know, all of these are points that just really kind of stand out to me in that way. Think about this. What does it take for unity to survive the pressure that these people were under? But then the follow-up, are there lessons here for the Lord's church? What application can we make when we look at what the pressure that these people were under? Are there lessons here for the Lord's church? What would you say? Yes.
God made our bodies so that when we get an injury and we start bleeding, we get a cut or we get a scrape, and all the white blood cells rush, rally to that area and start fixing the problem. And that was the trumpet. You know, he said, if you hear that we're too big and spread out to know if something's happening over there.
What's Nehemiah looking for all the time? He's watching for the enemy.
Right.
All the time.
Sometimes you need a trumpet. Sometimes you need everyone to rally, focus, concentrate on a certain problem that might arise in the church. Who knows what it may be in the future. But if we focus on that and say, okay, we got to conquer this because this is something ugly that's rising up. We need to talk about this. We need to blow a trumpet.
Yeah.
And everybody rally to conquer this enemy, whatever it may be, and I think that's what he did.
That's a good catchphrase to kind of keep in mind sometime. When there's an issue and there's a problem, when there's an enemy coming upon us, someone needs to blow the trumpet. We got to be ready for that.
You talk about unity, and I looked at this picture of the wall you have here. I mean, there are little stones, there are larger stones, but everybody was doing their part. And they were using the materials at hand, I presume. That's probably part of the rubble.
That's right. That's right.
And you know, I think sometimes we think I gotta be doing something big. You know, I've gotta put this big stone up there, but when we're only capable of maybe moving a little stone, that's the talents God has given us. But every stone mattered. And every stone built up the wall. Everybody doing their part.
There's some things that it seems to me the text doesn't really address, like when did they eat? And who fixed that food? And who brought water to the workers? I mean, there's some necessary elements there that somebody took care of. I mean, there was something for everyone to do, you know, in this endeavor right here. You know, there was a strong willingness to seek and work for a common goal. And that's how this whole thing kind of keeps moving forward here. I want us to think about this for a minute. Sometimes unity in the Lord's church is hard to find. It shouldn't be. And when it's hard to find, there are reasons for that, and the reasons all point at us. You know, when unity is hard to find. Some churches come to it easier than others because I think because their focus is a little bit more defined than other churches may be. But it's interesting that Scripture, and again, I'm focusing now on the New Testament church, there's a lot said about unity. I mean, it's interesting to me. And there has to be a reason for that. I mean, that it's a reoccurring point. There's got to be a reason for that. And it seems to me that that's one of the Lord's church today, one of the greatest issues that most churches face is internal strife and unity. course, on the other hand, I'm not sure that's anything new. There was a reason the inspired writers were talking about that in the first century. And in fact, there are some specifics that are dealt with sometime when there was a lack of unity that needed to be, issues that needed to be resolved. And so that's why I've been just really focused on this here with Nehemiah. Somehow, he was able to help the whole, help the group to see and stay focused on a common goal. And there was a willingness of those who were following and working to be focused on that goal and work together. And the Lord's church, we have to do that too. We have to be able to focus in that way. And so on page 13, there are several passages listed here. And these are all familiar passages. And I'm not planning to spend a lot of time on these, but just to kind of look through some of these passages quickly, and let's just make a brief comment or two about some of these. I mean, what can we learn about unity from these passages? What about Acts chapter 4? I mean, we're not very long after the establishment of the church when we are reading Acts chapter 4. And there was some particular needs in the church. Acts chapter 4 and verse 32. And the multitude of those who had believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither did anyone say that the things he possessed were his own, but they had all things in common. There were Christians, remember, in need. And, what do we learn from the passage about the issue and how it was dealt with? What can we see? What comments do you make?
Those that had, it was pretty simple. It's not that complicated.
It's very simple. It's just simple points. There was a need, and they took care of the need. Individuals were willing to work together to see to this need and taking care of it. The text goes on explaining that more. But I just want to make the point here that those who believe, that is those who had become baptized believers in the text, were of one heart and of one soul. Their mind was together. Their goal here was the same. Look at Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. Romans 14, verse 16, beginning. Maybe we're just introducing some thoughts here about attitude. He says in Romans 14, verse 16, "Therefore, do not let your good be spoken of as evil. For the kingdom of God is not food and drink, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. For he who serves Christ in these things is acceptable to God and approved by men. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify one another." Simple points. What would you say? I mean, what stands out in the passage? Does attitude matter? Common focus, a common attitude. You know, there's a comparison here made of the physical versus the spiritual. You know, our focus has to be on the spiritual. And with regard to our relationship together, even pursue peace and edify or build up. Just some simple thoughts. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I'd mentioned the fact that there's a lot said about unity, or sometimes lack of unity, among brethren in the first century. And 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10, the apostle says, "Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment." Well, why is he saying that?
They weren't.
He's trying to encourage them to be something that they were not. They were not unified. They were not of the same mind. They had their arguments and bickering, even to the point of, I was baptized by Cephas, but I was baptized by Apollos. I mean, it's like, are we struggling that hard to find something to argue about that we're going to argue about by whom we were baptized? And the apostles saying, there shouldn't be divisions like this. You know, can't you be of the same mind, that we should be perfectly joined together in the same mind and the same judgment? And so there's a reason why he's saying this. So just simple points from these passages. I'd like you to look at that some more here this week. Lord willing, we're going to be doing this class. Rick, you got all done with Galatians, right? Okay, so... So on Wednesday night, for the rest of the month, this class of Nehemiah is going to go Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights, okay? And so I say that there's going to be a couple of exceptions in there, but Lord willing, Wednesday night we're going to take up right here. So make sure you've got lesson 7 and kind of work through some of these scriptures there on the bottom of the page and applications on the back, page 14, and that's where we'll go Wednesday night. Appreciate your good comments.